Ladies and gentlemen, the sound you hear is a buzzsaw ripping through a painting of George Washington chopping down cherry trees. It's time for Professor Buzzkill, busting myths and taking names.
He's one of the most famous and celebrated generals in American history. Along with George Patton, however, he's also one of the most misunderstood and most mythologized. Douglas MacArthur, born in the 19th century, served in both World Wars, the Korean War, and in other less extensive U.S. military actions. He famously accepted the surrender of Japan in 1945 on the deck of the battleship Missouri. He oversaw its occupation by Allied forces, and he often gets credit for the reform and modernization of Japan, post-war Japan. Yet, he's also considered another attention hound like Patton, sometimes overly dramatic and often letting his overinflated view of his own abilities and destiny get in the way of sound judgment. Who was the real Douglas MacArthur? Well, last week, Buzzkillers, we wondered who was the real Douglas MacArthur, at least in terms of his early career. But as we said, he'll not fade away, and this question certainly won't fade away. So here we are back again with Professor Nash. Professor Nash, thanks for coming back to the bunker.
Always a pleasure. I like it in here.
It's very safe.
I'm going to be called Dugout Phil.
Yeah, that's right. And you're going to have the occupation of the Buzzkill Bunker. And one of the things we ended with last time was that MacArthur does the ceremony of the surrender of Japan on the USS Missouri. And then, of course, he's well to retirement age, but he doesn't retire. He's given another post. What happens?
He is, after all, 65, which in many walks of life is retirement age. But once again, you're starting to see this pattern is now well established, where now Japan is a defeated foe. We have to have an official occupation. Who's going to run it? Well, duh. Douglas MacArthur. I mean, who else would do it?
So he basically governed the Philippines, if you will. So
that's right. And on paper, he's got his resume is very impressive, right? Mm-hmm. And by the way, he's in World War II. He has added a ton of medals. And by the way, I should just add this parenthetically. It's going to sound like a gratuitous dig, but I don't think it is. If you look at his World War II record, he's constantly getting additional medals.
Right.
For things you wouldn't think would deserve a medal.
Oh.
Like one incident where he was flying from one base to another and one of the plane's four engines crapped out and they sort of landed anyway and he got a medal.
For what?
Meritorious passengership. I have no idea. But then that's not an isolated incident. And so then it's like, what's going on here? And I think it's part of what we were talking about before, where he's got this reputation. Basically, you have to feed the beast.
Right.
In other words, you have to keep recognizing him for every little thing. You have to keep showering him with medals, because otherwise he might be unhappy and his supporters might be unhappy. So it's easier just to avoid any of those potential headaches. So just keep giving him medals.
Wow. And this is as much a product of the domestic attitude, the domestic government attitude back in Washington towards him as it is his own aggrandizement.
Yeah. And sort of the political angle inside the Pentagon, where generals and admirals are also scared of him and scared of, sort of crossing him.
Wow. Wow.
So he is the obvious choice to be put in charge of the occupation of Japan. He's called, his new title is SCAP, the Supreme Commander Allied Powers.
All right.
He's given essentially dictatorial power over Japan.
Okay.
By the way, there's this famous photograph you can find online where he's posing with Emperor Hirohito. They're standing side by side.
Yeah.
He's a much bigger person.
Yeah.
And I think that was deliberate. I think that was partly to sort of knock the emperor. Remember, as we talked about in an earlier episode, the emperor is sort of this mysterious godlike figure.
That's right, yeah.
And part of the purpose of the Allied occupation is to sort of knock him down a few pegs.
Yeah. But they don't remove him. I've always thought that was
interesting. No, they don't remove him. And we'll talk about this maybe in a minute, but an Eisenhower doesn't want the emperor or anyone in his in the royal family touched, even though some of them, including the emperor, are implicated in war crimes.
You mean MacArthur doesn't want them
touched? He doesn't want them touched.
Okay.
Yeah.
Because you said Eisenhower.
I'm sorry.
That's okay, Buzz. We're juggling theaters here, Buzz Killers.
I'm so critical of MacArthur, I can't even bring myself to say his name. Yeah. No, so he's given dictatorial power, and it's not just any occupation. Everyone in the United States agrees that Japan needs to be reshaped.
Okay.
Japan was considered this incredibly brutal, incredibly destructive sort of menace to the international community, which it was. I mean, that's true. Yeah. And so it's some of its basic institutions need to be uprooted, and it's and it needs to be fundamentally reformed, not just occupied and have its wrist slapped.
Mm-hmm.
So on his staff drafts a new constitution for Japan. Japan becomes a parliamentary democracy. It had some of the trappings of democracy before World War II, but the military is basically in charge, and you know, civilian leaders were often assassinated. Wow. if they ever got in the way of the military. It was a thoroughly militarist dictatorship beforehand. The emperor is stripped of his military authority. Japan basically is not allowed to have an army.
Right.
Women get the right to vote.
Right.
So if a lot of this sounds like Japan is being made into a little United States, that's shouldn't surprise anybody.
That's what they're trying to do.
That's what they're trying to do. And, you know, if you're a democracy and you want to create another democracy, you're going to try to do it in your own image, right? That shouldn't surprise anybody.
Although, but they make it a parliamentary democracy rather than the U.S. system, which is slightly different.
Good point. Maybe. But, well, keep in mind that Japan also had, I know, for example, Japan's military was tailored along European lines.
Right, okay.
So openly. So I suspect maybe they think a European-style system might be better fixed. But they do other American-style things, like, for example, the police and local government are much more decentralized.
Mm-hmm.
They undertake a real land reform.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, Japan's land tenure system before the war was sort of semi-feudal.
Right.
So a lot of it is basically is bought up and redistributed.
But I can't imagine that MacArthur himself is coming up with a lot of these ideas. It sounds like there must have been some experts.
No, and that's an excellent point because, and this is going to sound like I'm relentlessly anti-MacArthur. I assure the listeners I am not. But if you criticize MacArthur, often people say, well, yeah, but look at the great job he did in Japan. And I think most people would agree that he did a pretty good job in Japan.
Mm-hmm.
But if you look at books like Michael Schaller, he makes it pretty clear that a lot of the basic reforms and the basic things that are put into place do not come from the head of Douglas MacArthur. They're actually staffed out ahead of time in Washington, D.C. And a lot of what he's doing is executing plans done by others.
Oh, all right. So he's in effect, although he probably wouldn't say it, he's in effect following orders from D.C.
And by the way, very selectively. And if you read Schaller, he's often out of sync. In other words, he's pursuing certain reforms at times when Washington doesn't want him to, or he's not pursuing reforms when they do want him to. I mean, he's still sort of a loose cannon. He's got his own interest. A lot of the reforms he undertakes or initiatives he pushes at particular times are not on their merits, but because, like, for example, 1948 is an election year.
Right. Yeah.
And he does certain things where he's trying to sort of, once again, pump himself up.
Mm-hmm.
And for example, his very selective pursuit of war crimes trials. People often forget about this. There were essentially Nuremberg trials
in
Japan because there were plenty of Japanese war criminals.
Yeah.
Including General Yamashita, who was in charge in the Philippines. MacArthur went after him full court press, even though you can argue that he really wasn't responsible for some of the things that happened under him.
But it was the Philippines and that was MacArthur's baby.
Right. And, you know, and so he's like pursuing certain war crimes trials far longer than the people in Washington want him to.
Oh, right.
And yet, on the other hand, he's also very selective about it. Hmm. We have a very good idea now about this infamous Unit 731.
Oh, what's that?
Which this was a secret Japanese unit basically to promote biological warfare.
Oh.
Buzzkiller should look into it. It's grimly fascinating. The Japanese, let me put it this way. The more we learn about World War II, the more the gap between the Japanese and the Nazis narrows. Unit
731. You mean in terms of ideological?
Ideological, and also just in terms of sort of atrocious behavior.
Yeah, that's what I mean.
The Japanese, the Unit 731, very active in China, all sorts of basically waging biological warfare.
Ugh.
In other words, basically aerial spraying of bacteria to cause infections that killed about 250,000 Chinese. Chinese civilian death, another great untold story of World War II, basically. Vivisection of humans.
Yeah.
You know, all sorts of grisly experiments. Anyway, we caught the people who ran Unit 731.
Yeah.
They should have been tried on war crimes. MacArthur, he was not alone in this. This was basically U.S. policy. But MacArthur was also very active in protecting the leaders of this unit from any prosecution. Basically, what? Because we wanted to make use of their findings.
Oh. No.
Yeah. And so and it's part of a bigger picture. We do the same thing in Europe. We protect a lot of Nazi war criminals.
That's right, yeah.
People like Klaus Barbie. You know, CIA protected him for years. But it's the same basic story. There are even cases, some of these people, the Soviets of all people, the Soviets want to prosecute these people and the Americans refuse.
Wow.
Americans refuse to hand them over to military tribunals. So that's a, so, and it's not, in other words, you can't say MacArthur was this sort of clearly moral figure in going after war criminals. Not at all. It's much more complicated than that. He went after some, and some were punished, some were executed.
Yeah.
And there, and the Japanese had plenty of bad people. A lot of them weren't prosecuted. Including these people in Unit 731, and partly because of people like MacArthur.
And also because apparently Washington wanted those findings sure. as well.
Yeah. By the time you get to 1949, 1950, the priority is the Cold War.
Oh, yeah.
And it's about integrating the Germans and the Japanese into the Western camp.
Right.
In Germany, right. Of course, it's also about using German manpower to defend against the Red Army.
Mm-hmm.
But we need these folks on board, and in Japan it's called the reverse course, where a lot of the reforms are sort of stopped. Like, for example, reforming of the Japanese conglomerates, the so-called Zaibatsu.
All right.
That is sort
major
of
corporations.
Major corporations. And these were basically monopoly concerns.
Sure.
They were openly militarist and very much part of the problem. Should have been broken up. Most people would agree. That is put on hold because, once again, the priority is worldwide Cold War. Same in Germany. Denazification is put on hold. A lot of war criminals have commuted sentences. So, I mean, attention has shifted away.
To the Cold
Absolutely.
War.
Yeah. You know, and there's a propaganda effort to make Germans and Japanese into good guys instead of bad guys, and making Russians and Chinese into bad guys instead of good guys. It's very complicated. Look what happens in Hollywood. It's really painful to watch that transition.
And of course, you have big events like the Chinese Revolution in 49. So
and Japan's on the front line.
Right. It's very easy to get the attention taken away from what had happened 3 or 4 years ago.
That's right.
4 or 5 years ago.
And by the way, throughout this period, not to beat the dead horse, but throughout this period, he runs his headquarters and his staff the way he had before, if anything, even worse, right? Uh-huh. Surrounded by yes men, obsessed with press releases and publicity. Obsessed with his own political goals, which mm-hmm. never come to fruition, obviously. In 44 and 48, he wants to be drafted.
As sort of president.
In other words, he essentially, and this should sound familiar, he essentially wants a deadlocked convention so that then he can be the dark horse hero who's brought out of retirement or brought out of the military to run for president. Mm-hmm. Never works out for him for a variety of reasons. But he definitely wants to be president until very late in the game.
Now, he's not pushing 70 exactly, but he's in his late 60s by this time.
He's in his late 60s.
Wow.
These days, that's obviously not a deal breaker.
Yeah, nowadays.
But back then, it would have been. But I think a lot of people would, you know, it's a long American tradition. We love our war hero presidents.
That's right. Yeah.
Way back into the early 19th century.
Yeah.
So a lot of people, you know, he was very popular. A lot of people. And remember, a lot of people are very unhappy with Harry Truman. In 1948, a lot of people, including Harry Truman, are convinced he's going to lose.
Yes.
People forget that Truman actually offered to step down and run as Ike's vice presidential candidate if Eisenhower ran as a Democrat in 1948.
Well, not only did I forget, they don't know. I didn't know that at all.
Pretty insane. even Harry Truman thought that Dewey was going to defeat Truman, like the famous headline said.
Holy cow.
Now, he changed his mind, obviously.
Yeah.
But Eisenhower would have
been better just to retire early.
You would
go back to the Senate at least. Anyway,
yeah, you would think. So in that sense, Eisenhower is much more clearly apolitical. People don't know what party he's going to pick.
Yeah, that's true. That's true.
And he was probably a bigger war hero and certainly had less baggage than the Douglas MacArthur. Yeah. But so he's still in charge of American forces in the Far East when the Korean War breaks out in June of 1950.
Right.
And Buzzkillers, just to check, Korea had actually been annexed by Japan in 1910 and had been under Japanese rule for decades.
Oh, right.
Japan loses. It's quote-unquote liberated. It is divided temporarily, quote-unquote.
Yeah.
Temporarily at the 38th parallel, merely for the purpose of disarming Japanese forces on the peninsula.
Oh, okay.
It was pretty arbitrary and it was technical. Everyone on both sides believed that Korea would be a unified country.
You mean the Soviet Chinese side and also the
right.
South Korean side.
Okay. That's right. Well, to keep in mind that in the late 40s, it's still Republican China.
Sorry, that's right. Yes, you're right. Yeah. Buzzkillers, we've got to keep our dates straight.
That's right. So you had the Red Army. And remember, the Red Army had attacked Japanese forces in Manchuria. So the Red Army was very active.
It's already
in the area.
There, yeah.
So they're given in charge of the northern part.
Mm-hmm.
And the Americans are given charge of the southern part, just, quote unquote, just for disarming the Japanese. Well, as the Cold War emerges, very quickly you see basically respective loyal regimes pop up. You basically have de facto civil war conditions
right.
in Korea before June 1950. You have I have to remember to keep my Kim straight. Kim Il-sung is sort of a North Korean communist who's put in charge in the north. Syngman Rhee is put in charge of the south. Both countries are sort of roped into respective camps in the Cold War.
Right.
And June 25th, 1950, North Korea attacks South Korea. Very quickly, the Truman administration agrees that we have to protect South Korea.
Right.
The problem is
because it's a 1-2 punch. It's the Chinese Revolution and then
Korea. It's a horrible time. These are some of the darkest days of the Cold War. Within months in 1949, not only does China go communist, which was a disaster, Soviets detonated their own atomic bomb.
Yes,
before
that's right.
So our ace in the hole is gone. Right, the atomic bombs now cancel each other out. And remember, the Soviets have a much bigger army, and the Chinese have lots of manpower at their disposal.
Maybe Truman was prescient; he didn't want to be president when all this stuff was about to happen.
It's like, do you have any idea what's about to happen? You should not want this office.
Retire.
Yeah, and we have these spy scandals, like the Klaus Fuchs case, the Rosenbergs. These are all breaking out early 1950. We decided to develop the hydrogen bomb. Joe McCarthy gets his start with his McCarthyite campaigns early 1950. And it's a really dark time.
Yeah, from a distance, we often think of the Cold War as Cold War paranoia and everything is sort of unnecessary and overreaction. But this way, when you see it this way, it's sort of understandable that there was this scare.
No, people like McCarthy had all sorts of material to work with. People were legitimately scared without him. Before McCarthy comes in, you have movies being made like, well, I was a communist for the FBI. It was 1951, but there are others that are before 1950, and the Red Scare is well underway, and anti-communism is already a political tool well before McCarthy comes on the scene, and it's already being used to hammer the Truman administration. In any case, Truman and his advisors feel like they have no choice but to intervene. And of course, who's in charge of U.S. forces at the time? Douglas MacArthur.
In the whole Pacific. That's right.
And this war goes very poorly at first. In fact, the token U.S. force and South Korean forces are almost pushed off the peninsula.
Oh, that far south?
Oh, yeah.
The north comes that far south? Okay.
Partly because, we had downsized our military, if anything, too much after 1945. Understandably, in democracy, you want to bring all the troops home.
Sure.
U.S. forces that were in Japan, the 8th Army under MacArthur, they had been allowed to atrophy. They were basically flabby, out of shape, poorly equipped. So we rush troops over to Korea, and they're creamed in the first weeks.
Right.
But we very quickly get our act together. We rush in reinforcements, and Eisenhower.
Yeah.
I want Eisenhower to be in command, damn it. MacArthur is then basically stages probably the greatest military coup of his career, which is the Incheon landing. It's an amphibious landing behind North Korean lines, more or less near the 38th parallel, so way behind what are then North Korean lines.
Now, this is a big amphibious landing. This is at least D-Day size.
No.
No?
No, not as big as D-Day.
Okay.
I forget the exact size, but it's not. D-Day was like 6 Allied divisions.
Okay.
I think this is more like 2.
All right.
But it's risky, but creating your own luck, right? They always talk about that.
Yeah.
It's a bold move. Some people think it's not going to work. It does. It works brilliantly.
Mm-hmm.
The North Koreans are caught by surprise. The beaches really aren't defended very much. By this point, their offensive is running out of steam and they're overextended.
The North Koreans are.
The North Koreans. And by the way, in the big picture, North Korea ends up looking a little bit like the North African campaign of World War II, where the worst thing you can do is advance.
Yeah,
because then you become overextended. Your supply lines get longer and longer. Your forces become weak as they become more concentrated and strengthened and closer to their base. I think the same thing happens in North Korea as you move up and down the peninsula. Our forces, by the way, had been pushed down to this tiny perimeter in the southeast around Busan, but we held on to that, and then exploiting our huge superiority at sea and in the air.
Right,
MacArthur lands at Incheon.
Okay,
Incheon. completely turns things around. North Korean forces are shattered. They're routed. They're not just defeated. They're routed and they're sent in headlong retreat. And here's where it gets complicated.
Okay.
Because up until this point, the goal has been to liberate, quote unquote, South Korea.
South Korea.
South Korea.
Because it had been, the North Koreans had
but lead us not into temptation, right?
Right.
In the deep Cold War now is a unique opportunity. We've got them on the run. We can not only preserve the South, but liberate the North.
From the Chinese and the Russians.
And this had been agreed to in the Truman administration already in the summer. Incheon's in September 15th, 1950. Already in the summer, when we're looking like we're not probably going to be able to turn things around, it's not going to be a complete disaster, they're already talking about liberating the North. So this was not, crossing the 38th parallel was not MacArthur being renegade.
Okay, now this is a very big sort of myth or misconception, is because as I was always taught, and I always thought, you know, MacArthur was told from D.C., from Truman, push them back above the 38th parallel, and then that's it.
And then relax. Yeah. No, that's not true. No, this was official U.S. policy. Now, in terms of the actual execution of this policy of liberating the North, he didn't go about it in a very sound way.
Yeah.
And here's where the bad Douglas MacArthur returns.
Okay.
And by bad Douglas MacArthur, I mean reckless, imperious, arrogant,
and insubordinate.
Insubordinate. Well, maybe not so much insubordinate, but for example, ignoring news and information that doesn't fit with what you want to happen.
Okay.
And by this, I mean, remember, North Korean forces are on the run and retreating north toward the Chinese border. Remember, North Korea borders on Manchuria, which is part of China, and separated by the Yalu River.
Right.
That's the border. And so North Korean forces are in headlong retreat. But remember, the previous fall, China had fallen to the communists under Mao Zedong. The Chinese are very concerned that Americans are going to show up on their border and publicly warn the Allies. And remember, this is, by the way, this is a UN effort. Technically, MacArthur is a UN commander.
Right, that's right, that's right, that's right.
The Soviets dropped the ball. They didn't have their dude at the UN when they could have vetoed the Uniting for Peace resolution.
Yeah, right.
So this got the official stamp of international approval. So he's technically head of the UN forces in Korea. The Chinese make it quite clear that we are not going to tolerate American forces on our border.
Mm-hmm.
Then they start introducing troops, the Chinese do, into North Korea in October.
Okay.
They don't really do much at first, but they're there.
Right.
We know they're there.
And there's potential for more.
Potential for more. MacArthur ignores the Chinese warnings and ignores the signs that there's a serious Chinese force already in North Korea.
Mm-hmm.
Any contrary evidence, he's either not interested in gathering or ignores. He allows his forces to become grossly overextended. I urge people to look online. They advance, UN forces advance very, very far up the east coast of North Korea, mm-hmm. but not in the middle.
All right.
So they can easily be cut off if there's a serious counteroffensive, which almost happens. And then end of November 1950, the Chinese counterattack with massive forces. They have something like 300,000 quote-unquote people's volunteers.
Yeah.
Just so we're clear, they're not volunteers.
Yeah.
This is, after all, Mao Zedong's China.
Right.
Check here if you'd like to serve in Korea. No, that's not what happens. But they counterattack with great force, and it's a rout. And here, and you saw this in World War II, by the way, but you certainly see it here. MacArthur, very temperamental, very emotional. He has these radical mood swings. One minute, he's invincible. We will completely conquer the entire world with this minimal force.
Yeah.
To the next minute, the sky is falling. We're doomed. We need to evacuate Korea. There's nothing we can do to save the. I mean, that's sort of him in a nutshell. There's no sort of middle ground. He panics, or he, at least briefly, he panics.
Yeah.
Yeah. Temperamentally, he's not a great general. Mm-hmm. And that's the kind of thing I was going to say this earlier. Might as well say it now. I'd have to think hard about this. I suspect he might be a candidate for the Peter Principle.
All right.
I think if you look at you rise to your level of incompetence. If you look at his World War I and earlier his career, he's a great junior commander.
Right.
He's great tactically and maybe even operationally. But once you put him in charge of armies and army groups and make him a strategist, sort of out of his depth.
Oh, it's beyond him. Okay.
Yeah, and partly because of his personality and his narcissism.
Yeah.
And you know, if you're any effective commander should want contrary evidence put in front of you.
Oh, sure.
Yeah. So you can weigh all of it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It's for years now, all of his subordinates know that if there are reports of strong Chinese troop concentrations, you either downplay them or ignore them. You've never put them in front of the commander because he doesn't want to hear them. That is a recipe for disaster in pretty much any walk of life, certainly in the military.
Wow.
So in any case, in this time, UN forces are routed and driven way south, back beyond the 38th parallel. Seoul is recaptured by Chinese and North Korean forces.
Right.
December 1950 is a really dark time in Washington. Everything seems to be going wrong. Communism's on the march.
And Truman's getting the blame for all this, right?
Truman's getting the blame for all this.
This is the famous "to err is Truman."
To err is Truman, yeah. And by the way, that's the sad story of Truman. He has this remarkable come-from-behind election victory, and very quickly, even before Korea, 1949, his approval rating tanks. Things start to go wrong for him. He, for some good reasons, I guess, had presided over a weaker military, which and then we then find out and then have to pump up because of Korea on the fly. So it's a really dark day in Washington, and here's where, among other problems for Truman, is MacArthur's insubordination starts to become clearer and clearer. Because here's the
debate. So we're not certain, or it's technically difficult to say that Incheon was insubordinate. No?
Incheon was not insubordinate.
Okay, even though that's above the 30th parallel?
Well, no. Actually, that is below the 30th parallel.
Okay.
And is decisive in liberating the South. But then the question is, now what do we do? Now that we've liberated the South and they're on the run, now do we do it? And partly because, I should have said this earlier, because Truman and others want a major victory, in other words, it's no longer containment, it's now what they call rollback, right? You're actually liberating communist areas.
Yeah.
Right, they took China. Maybe for once, we could actually liberate a communist area. That temptation was too great to pass up.
Yeah,
and it blew up in our faces. And so now you have this sort of fork in the road. By January 1951, it's pretty clear, especially with the new ground commander in Korea, the 8th Army Commander Matthew Ridgway, another World War II hero, very, very competent. He basically stops the tide. It's pretty clear to people in the Truman White House that now what we need to do is dial this back. Now's the time to acknowledge that we went too far. We have maybe a stalemate shaping up. We have an opportunity to negotiate a peace.
Yeah.
But
and it's almost certain that the rest of the UN would go along with that.
Absolutely. Everyone was spooked in November 1930 when Truman made a careless public comment about maybe using nuclear weapons.
Yeah.
The British freaked out, by the way. Clement Attlee ran to Washington and basically said, you know, y'all are kidding, right? So people were scared, but the Truman administration, they basically, cooler heads have prevailed.
Okay.
Keep in mind, February 1950, the brand new People's Republic of China forms a public alliance with the Soviet Union.
Yeah.
So widening the war, quote unquote, in other words, doubling down and taking the war to China might mean World War III. And remember, we no longer have a nuclear monopoly. World War III all of a sudden sounds like a really bad idea. That's the conclusion of the Truman administration. Let's dial this back. Let's embrace the new reality, which is limited war makes sense. Limited war for limited means.
Sure.
Negotiate a peace. Let well enough alone, and let's accept the fact that we've successfully liberated South Korea from destruction.
Which is eventually what they have to do.
That's what they have to do, and that's where we are today.
Right.
Basically. And the good news is South Korea has become a big success story, even a democracy.
Right,
and
right,
North
right.
Korea is a unique hellhole on earth. Yeah. It's not an exaggeration. Parenthetically, and it's a good test because they're ethnically the same. North Koreans are on average 6 inches shorter than South Koreans today.
Incredible.
Because of their poor diet and their impoverishment. Anyway, MacArthur takes it a very different direction. MacArthur, his hackles are up.
Mm-hmm.
He was humiliated. He wants payback. He immediately starts talking about broadening the war.
Even though there's every indication that it would be World War III, he still wants to do it?
Yeah, well, he basically doesn't worry about it. And he swings to the other mode, which is essentially bring it. World War III, we've got superior forces, we would prevail. Whew. Yeah, that's my reaction. And his problem is he goes public with this. He starts making public noises that what we need to do, because Asia is so important, and as he says publicly more than once, Asia will be essentially the center of the human universe for the next 10,000 years, which means he has pretty powerful powers of prediction.
Yeah, that's
most right. people say tomorrow, no, 10,000 years, because he is obsessed with Asia. It's now become part of him. He starts to believe his own hype. In any case, he basically says, look, if the Chinese are going to get involved, then we need to bring the war to China. We need to start bombing targets in China. It's controversial. We don't know for sure to the extent to which he does this. He may have started talking about maybe using nuclear weapons in China.
Wow.
We know for a fact that he proposed at one point, and I love this. This is certainly the early Cold War talking. He proposes laying down a belt of radioactive waste along the entire Yalu.
The border between North Korea and China. Talk about biological warfare.
Right. In other words, today it's more along lines of a dirty bomb. In other words, you don't necessarily detonate nuclear weapons, but you just sort of make the entire border radioactive so humans can't pass through it.
Ugh.
Yeah. Like I said, it's early in the Cold War.
Yeah.
People are still working their way towards solutions when it comes to things nuclear.
Yeah.
And long story short, there's this basic disagreement. In December 1950, Truman clearly orders MacArthur and all commanders, by the way, no public utterances by any commanders contrary to policy. You want to do that internally, fine, but don't do it in public.
Well, you would have thought that that was almost a given. Why would they need to reinforce that?
Exactly,
that with the
and
commanders?
You're absolutely right. And that is another indication of how far this has gone.
Yeah, you mean MacArthur's
MacArthur's
individualism, if you will.
MacArthur's infinitely long leash, where both his alleged superiors, both civilian and military, refuse to rein him in, refuse to sort of issue orders to him, refuse to tell him otherwise. And there's this clearly he's diverging from official policy, and he's going public.
Even though this is kind of an order now, Truman has said,
stop publicly airing your disagreements. Rushing ahead to April 5th, 1951, this is the decisive step when Joe Martin, who was the Republican minority leader in the House, publicly reveals a letter that MacArthur had written him weeks earlier.
Okay.
In which Eisenhower, long story short, says in this letter to a Republican. So this is to a member of the opposition.
Hang on. Eisenhower says this to
him? Did I just say Eisenhower?
You did.
Can we just do an Eisenhower show so I can get this out of my system?
We have Eisenhower mania all up in here.
Wow. I need to go and see my World War II shrink. MacArthur. MacArthur had written a private letter to a leader of the opposition in which he says, we cannot afford to let Asia fall to the communists. And once again, notice the exaggeration, right? Does anyone really think that all of Asia is going to fall to communism? Yeah.
Including Japan.
No. Right. Yeah. It's like, no, we have naval superiority. The island chains like the Philippines and Taiwan and Japan, pretty easily defensible against the Chinese. In any case, and more importantly, he says, we must win. In other words, we should stop playing for stalemate.
Mm-hmm.
We should play to win. And he says in the letter, famously, there is no substitute for victory.
Oh, another. Now that's where that quote comes from.
Okay. That's one of his In fact, there's one of the big books on the Korean War is actually called A Substitute for Victory. Because that's what we find in the end is a substitute for victory.
Sure.
And I think it's very, very important sort of historically because it shows just sort of the clash of worldviews.
Uh-huh.
And it's one of the reasons why MacArthur is so celebrated when he is sacked finally right after this and when he returns as a hero. Because keep in mind, the American public had been conditioned for 4 years of World War II, basically in a black and white worldview. The enemy are the bad guys, we're the good guys, and you go all out to crush them.
Mm-hmm.
And there is no substitute for victory. It's total war for total victory.
Right.
Until they wave the right flag, the white flag, you keep fighting.
Now, is there any indication that this letter, it's a private letter, but is there any indication that MacArthur either wanted to become public or wrote it knowing that it might get out? Or
that I don't know. I mean, I don't think he was pissed off at Joe Martin when he revealed it.
Okay. Well, that's a pretty strong indication.
Yeah. And, MacArthur's ought to have been savvy enough that if it's a private letter, that should stay private. In the letter, you say confidential.
Yeah.
And don't release this. And he didn't.
Yeah.
You know, and he's been so insubordinate publicly in so many other ways that this is not anything new.
This is just
a particularly extreme version, and it ends up being the straw that breaks the camel's back. Okay. Truman finally agrees to relieve him of command, which he does in mid-April 1951, and all hell breaks loose at home.
Yeah.
Much worse. I mean, Truman and his people feared a backlash, The Joint Chiefs of Staff certainly did, which is why they were sort of weaselly about this whole question. They wanted Truman to do all the dirty work. In any case, it does blow up in Truman's face. There's a huge public outcry, public protests, large public protests.
MacArthur's welcomed home as a hero.
MacArthur is welcomed home as a hero. Truman is burned in effigy, which does not happen every day. By the way, even Obama, for as much Obama hatred syndrome there is out there, I don't remember him being burned in effigy. I know. I remember there were some Tea Party rallies where they carried around monkey dolls.
Yeah, yeah.
With Obama's head, but not burned in effigy. It's a huge outcry. And like you said, MacArthur comes home to a hero's welcomes, putting it mildly. He gets the sort of treatment that is usually withheld for astronauts and Eisenhower and Charles Lindbergh.
Right. Ticker tape parade.
Down Madison Avenue. Yeah. So rapturous welcome. The Republicans gleefully invite him to address Congress, where he gives this famous speech, at the end of which he says, basically, you know, and he's announcing his retirement, and he basically says, old soldiers never die. He quotes a soldier's ballad, old soldiers never die, they just fade away, which, frankly, I've never understood. it strikes me as one of the greatest public quotes that really don't make sense if you look at them carefully.
Well, I always just assumed it was that their reputation lives on and their glory lives on after their biological death. But it is, yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
Because so many of them don't fade away. They don't really. I mean, they retire. Old generals, anyway.
Right.
Usually stay on until nearly death. It's like Supreme Court justice. Right.
Or they find some way of staying in the limelight, which he really doesn't. He becomes a corporate board, head of a corporate board. But he lives. By the way, he lives until 1964.
Mm-hmm.
Dies at the age of 84.
Yeah. Which is
After, by the way, one of his last public acts, if you call it that, is he counsels both John F. Kennedy and Lyndon Johnson not to get involved in a land war in Asia.
Right. Now, that's true? Because I've often heard that's
true. That's true.
Okay.
A lot of good it did.
Well, but that seems but odd for someone who wanted to reconquer every Philippine island.
I mean, it's not exactly a deathbed conversion, but sort of reflects maybe some learning on his part. Right, yeah. which is sort of impressive, but in the immediate aftermath of his being relieved of command, the Republicans, not surprisingly, gleefully rush to take advantage of this.
Yeah,
not only do they invite him to speak, and he gives that famous speech, but they open hearings on the MacArthur firing, and it very quickly blows up in their faces. It's quite clear very early on that he was clearly insubordinate.
Yeah,
repeatedly. That Truman was well within his rights to sack him. Mm-hmm. That there was no scandal. There was no conspiracy. There was no breaking of the law. And the hearings sort of fade away. They were a huge media spectacle at first, but then they drag on.
Yeah.
MacArthur's not terribly impressive when he testifies, and very quickly it sort of devolves into Republicans bashing Truman's China policy going back to 1949.
All right.
And then MacArthur does not run in 1952. I think by this point, even he's sort of given up. He supported Robert Taft, who was the big challenger Dwight Eisenhower in 1952. Yeah. Right. This is sort of the isolationist versus internationalist battle being carried out for the last time. Eisenhower wins decisively. And of course, it bugs MacArthur no end.
Well, I was going to ask, is there any indication what MacArthur thought of Eisenhower as a potential president?
He was not happy. There was a big rivalry there. I mean, they sort of got along. They could be cordial when they met, and they did meet even during the Korean War. But, you know, during the Korean War in 1951, Eisenhower, who had been president of Columbia University, of all things, was actually brought out of retirement to be the first military commander of NATO in Europe.
Yeah. Yeah.
MacArthur not really happy with that appointment.
Yeah,
and once again, I think he thought that Eisenhower wasn't worthy, and the feeling was mutual. Eisenhower just worked for MacArthur way too long, knew him way too well. Lots of mutual hostility there.
But you could see that MacArthur's looking on him. This guy is still my subordinate or still my inferior. Right.
Well, and now he achieved what I always wanted, which was to be president of the United States.
Yeah,
I don't know this for a fact, but I can only assume that MacArthur was not very happy about that, considering his own ambitions.
Right, right.
Okay. But yeah, so he dies in 1964. Not that I have by all means mastered the huge literature on Douglas MacArthur, it is huge and getting huger. I always liked what his Australian ground forces, a general by the name of Blamey, said during World War II, or after World War II, actually. He said, and I quote, "The best and worst things you hear about him are both true." Which is interesting, but I want to avoid, at least from my own standpoint, I want to avoid the sort of 50-50 history, right, where where everything becomes completely neutral, because you can make a list on the one hand, on the other hand. To me, the bad definitely outweighs the good, but people like me should acknowledge, you know, the strengths of MacArthur, certainly brave, charismatic, inspirational.
And you said he's a very good junior commander, the World War I experience.
Also, ask yourself this question. Where do all the yes men come from?
Oh, right.
Right? Are these all people just cynically careerist? There's a lot of evidence out there that these are true believers. These people who meet him and they're blown away. They think they've concluded they're in the presence of greatness and that they should spend their career working for him.
Okay.
There's got to be some there, right? Yeah, that cannot be just 100% puffery and self-promotion.
But there are some people who are his subordinates and then don't, if you will, swallow the Kool-Aid.
Like Eisenhower. Yeah, I get to say that again legitimately. Like Eisenhower, yes. And there are others. Yeah. There are others who sort of realize what they're dealing with and try to step away. The defense of Bataan, the occupation of Japan, Incheon invasion, those all, he deserves credit for all those, right?
Right.
I mean, you know, there are some real military achievements there. So, you know, there's a lot of reason to like him. I was just looking at this book, you know, Winston Groom,
who wrote
Forrest Gump.
Yeah.
He apparently has become sort of a pop historian recently, and I was just looking at a book of his in which he talks about Patton and MacArthur and George Marshall. Mm-hmm. He has very good things to say about MacArthur. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you can find a lot of people who still sort of defend him. You can find also a lot of people who, like me, are very critical of him because, you know, in a field where you have a lot of people who are self-centered and self-promotional and narcissistic, other generals like Mark Clark, for example.
Right.
I still put MacArthur in his own category. I mean, there are narcissists and then there are super pathological narcissists. And he belongs in that latter category. I mean, most leading generals are interested in publicity.
Yeah.
Not to that extent.
Not even Patton.
Not even close.
Yeah.
No, Patton's a piker when it comes to self-promotion compared to MacArthur.
But there does seem to be this kind of trend or tendency for, at least in the popular mind, for people to celebrate the flashy generals, the Pattons
with part all his,
and the MacArthurs with all his.
And there were similarities. There were deliberate affectations. For example, the corncob pipe.
Yeah.
Right. The sort of the physical, personal style that Patton affected. MacArthur did the same thing.
Right.
Probably for at least in part some of the same reasons. In other words, I have to be inspirational, and you be inspirational by standing out, by being different, by being maybe even eccentric at times. Right. And that effective leaders build a persona like we talked about when we talked about Patton. I think there's some of that here. But, and, you know, to say that someone is worse along those lines than Patton, that's saying something.
Yeah.
But for example, Patton did not spend half of his time in the headquarters writing press releases. Maybe that's unfair, but a lot of time. In other words, refusing to delegate press releases. And Patton did not, as far as I know, just relentlessly personalize the achievements of the force fighting under him.
Yeah.
Which is what MacArthur did.
Yeah.
And Patton on the battlefield, not nearly as emotional and certainly much more competent than
competent
MacArthur.
Almost all the way through his whole career, not just as a junior
captain. Sure. And you know, as we said before, a lot of Patton's mistakes were sort of off the battlefield. On the battlefield are relatively rare. There are a couple of them, but they're relatively rare. Deserves much more credit as a battlefield commander than MacArthur does.
Seems to be, like I say, but it's these flashy guys rather than the ones who are very competent and very, like Marshall and Bradley and everything. No, not flawless by any means, but people have forgotten them almost completely.
Yeah, look at the people in MacArthur's own command. People like Eichelberger and Kenny, the people I mentioned before. These, from what I've read, are terrific commanders.
Right.
Who knows their names?
Yeah.
And yet they're very senior, right? These are people who basically command either air forces or armies respectively, and deserve a huge amount of credit for the victories that were scored in the Pacific.
So the publicity machine, the narcissism machine that we talked about in the first episode about MacArthur, not only continues throughout his, you know, post-World War II career and well into when he gets back home, but long after his death.
Long after his death, yeah. You know, and that's going to sound sort of like a nasty criticism of people who say nice things about him, right? Yeah. Like, you've bought into the myth as well.
Yeah.
But I don't know. I think you see this with other subjects. I think you know, what sells a biography?
Right.
Right?
Yeah.
You know, especially World War II biographies. Mm-hmm. We don't want to read about our disasters, right? We don't want to read about incompetence. We want to read about greatness.
And so we don't necessarily want to read about sort of bland competence. Exactly. Like, you know, maybe Marshall's considered a blandly competent.
Right.
Yeah.
Right, exactly. Right. Great example. Who attracts more attention today? Right. Who knows who George C. Marshall was?
Yeah.
Much more important as an architect of our victory than either Patton or MacArthur or Eisenhower.
Right.
Than any of them.
Right, right. And then, of course, the Marshall Plan and all this. But anyway, this.
And yet he's not a relentless self-promoter, so he doesn't get noticed.
Yeah. And we probably won't have a show about him.
Oh. Wait, so I don't get to call him Eisenhower?
Well, thank you so much, Professor. It's been wonderful again. We've gotten a lot of mileage out of MacArthur, but there's a lot of mileage to get out of MacArthur.
Absolutely.
After all, he's certainly one of the dominant figures of the 20th century and certainly one of the dominant popular figures of the 20th century. So there you have it, Buzzkillers. The real Douglas MacArthur has stood up, and he's very complicated. Talk to you next week. Peppercast.